Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed, your host. Today's program is the final segment of our two-part series on Federal Communications Commission reforms. You'll hear from Steve Waldman. He directed the FCC's comprehensive study on the state of U.S. journalism. Waldman delivered the keynote address during a recent symposium on the far-reaching report. But first, you'll hear from the FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski. He announced a policy change this week related to one of the main recommendations of Waldman's report, to provide all Americans with broadband internet service. Genachowski said during a speech on Monday that the FCC is addressing the challenge of a fast-changing media industry and fostering growth in the broadband industry.
There's never been a more exciting and challenging time to be at the FCC. Broadband internet, wired and wireless, is the most transformative new technology. First national broadband plan, a comprehensive strategy to build a world-leading broadband infrastructure and bring the benefits of high-speed internet to all Americans. For the past 2 years, we've been working to implement that plan, and 2011 was a year of accomplishment for all of the commissioners and staff at the FCC. We adopted a major modernization and overhaul of the largest part of the Universal Service Fund and of the related intercarrier compensation system, multi-billion dollar a year program that we've reformed for the modern age to meet our 21st century strategic goals. We put in place strong and balanced rules to preserve internet freedom and openness and spur investment and innovation throughout the broadband economy. And indeed, over the last year, if you look at the broadband economy, both network and infrastructure and also apps and services across the ecosystem, investment up, innovation up, jobs up. It's a thriving sector of our overall economy, although there is still much more work to do.
To provide more broadband access, Genachowski said the agency will reform a program that was designed to subsidize phone service to help low-income Americans. The FCC's Lifeline program provides discounts on monthly telephone service for people who are just above or below the poverty level.
Beginning the process of modernizing Lifeline from telephone service to broadband. Broadband has gone from being a luxury to a necessity in the 21st century. It's essential for finding a job, for example, as job postings have moved online, and for landing a job as companies increasingly require basic digital skills. Over 80% of Fortune 500 companies do all of their job postings online and require online applications. But one-third of Americans haven't adopted broadband at home. And the majority of low-income Americans are non-adopters. This is a negative cycle where the people who most need broadband access in order to find a job, develop skills, participate in our economy, are at the biggest disadvantage. We know there are three primary barriers to broadband adoption: cost, digital literacy, and relevance. All of our work, the work of Pew and other entities, confirms this. Relevance refers to the fact that too many Americans don't perceive broadband as having value for them. Now, as I said before, there's no single solution to closing the broadband adoption gap. That's why the FCC has taken a number of steps in this area, including working to launch the Connect to Compete initiative, which enlists government, nonprofit, and private sector leaders to tackle the barriers to adoption. On digital literacy, partners ranging from Best Buy to the nation's libraries have made significant commitments to teach Americans basic digital skills. On cost, the cable industry is rolling out a basic $9.95 a month broadband plan for families with kids on school lunch programs. It's a very significant initiative. Government is another powerful tool for accelerating broadband adoption. For example, the winners of the FCC's Apps for Communities Challenge developed tools to help people find jobs, connect the homeless with services, and let public transportation riders know when their bus is arriving. And in general, accelerating e-government at the points where government interacts with low-income citizens is a real opportunity to address the barriers that we've identified to broadband adoption. Cost, as I mentioned, members of Connect to Compete are making broadband service as well as computers available to low-income Americans at significantly discounted rates. We believe that Lifeline, a program that ensures low-income Americans can afford vital communications, can and should be part of the solution. That's why the order I'll circulate to my fellow commissioners tomorrow includes ensuring the availability of broadband to low-income Americans as an expressed program goal. And as a first step toward transitioning the program to support broadband, it would establish a broadband adoption pilot program using savings from other reforms. The pilot program would test and determine how Lifeline can best be used to increase broadband adoption among Lifeline-eligible consumers. The program would start by soliciting applications from broadband providers and would select a number of projects to fund starting this year. Lifeline would help reduce the monthly cost of broadband services, but applicants would be expected to help address other challenges to broadband adoption, including the cost of devices and digital literacy issues. Data from all the projects, together with data from other low-income broadband adoption programs around the country, including BTOP projects, Comcast Internet Essentials, and CenturyLink's Internet Basics, would be rigorously analyzed to ensure a full understanding of how best to transition Lifeline to support broadband. And a proposal that accompanies the order seeks comment on using savings from Universal Service Fund reforms to increase digital literacy training at libraries and schools, which could eventually arm more Americans with the digital skills they need to fully participate in our 21st century economy and society. Lots of people have worked to bring together our broadband adoption initiatives in general and our Lifeline reforms in particular. I do want to thank the people who contributed ideas to the proposed order, especially the states and the Joint Board, as well as the Government Accountability Office, GAO, which has studied the program and made suggestions over the years. I want to commend the staff of the FCC for their hard work crafting this proposal. And I want to thank my fellow commissioners for their input. This has been a subject of discussion internally, and their input is reflected in many parts of the draft order. I look forward to working with both of my colleagues to ensure that the Lifeline program is efficient, fiscally responsible, and that we modernize it to meet the needs of low-income Americans in a broadband world.
So the FCC is beginning to follow some of the recommendations in Steve Waldman's reports, which is a thorough examination of today's news media. The report found local journalism in crisis, with newspapers declining and online media failing to replace the accountability reporting that is being lost. Waldman outlined those problems during the symposium that was hosted by the Missouri School of Journalism and the Reynolds Institute.
As Barbara said, the chairman of the FCC about 2.5 years ago asked me to pull together this project, and there were two big questions to it. One was, we obviously saw all the changes going on, both the contraction of newspapers and the rise of digital innovation, but it was a little hard to tell how it was netting out. So as a matter of the health of democracy, are citizens and communities getting the information they need? And secondly, is public policy in sync with the nature of modern media markets? Especially given that much of public policy in the communications area was written before there was an internet, and in some cases before there was a TV set. So we looked at the, sort of did a tour of the media landscape. We started with newspapers because a lot of the core reporting came from that. And there was one, I think, misconception that you hear sometimes, that if only the newspapers had, you know, been more on their toes and had embraced the digital technology earlier, they wouldn't have this problem. And I wish it were that simple. From 2005 to 2009, the website traffic of newspaper websites doubled. So that led to an increase of digital revenue of $719 million, which sounds impressive until you remember that during that same period, print ad revenue dropped by $22.6 billion. And that led to the famous saying of print dollars being replaced by digital dimes, or nickels or pennies. And it's a fact that needs to always be kept in mind because it points out why it's so hard to outrun on the digital side what you're losing on the print side. And it points to difficulties in creating business models for digital properties. So what matters about this was not that these newspapers are making less money, but how it ripples through the news ecosystem. We spent a lot of time looking at staffing, because I think actually at the end of the day, that's as useful a proxy for what's being lost as news production is. Staffing at newspapers is now at the level we estimate before Watergate. So it's, nationally it's about 25 to 30% drop, but in many newsrooms it's been cut in half. And you can see this obviously ripple through coverage. And there have been some city-by-city studies. Pew looked at Baltimore. They found a 32% drop in the number of stories over the course of a decade. Another group looked at Philadelphia, found a consistent drop. Another study was of Raleigh-Durham, where the News and Observer went from 250 employees in 2004 to 103. And the interesting thing there is that the beats that were lost included courts, schools, legal affairs, agriculture, environment, and state education. Statehouse coverage has been very hard hit. So from 2003 to 2008, pretty short window, the number of reporters covering statehouses dropped by a third. During that same period, the amount of money that states were spending didn't comply and go down by a third. It actually went up by 20%. So if you're concerned about husbanding, you know, watching taxpayer money, that's not a good formula. Investigative reporting is really a key area. It's a little hard to define. Means different things to different people, but there's some clues. The number of members of the IRE dropped from 5,400 to 4,000 from 2003 to 2010. Number of submissions to the Pulitzer Prize public service category dropped 43% since the 1980s. So these are clues that the person power working on in-depth reporting is declining.
Waldman then raised the question of what the government's role is in addressing these problems.
So what can be done about this? Now, controversially, we actually said in this report that the government was not the main player in this drama, which didn't go over that well with some people, and was actually very popular with other people. The Wall Street Journal loved that part. But we do think that there are some really significant things that the government can do to help. First, disclosure, both starting with the FCC itself. As you may know, there's a licensing system, and we had this great big part of the report that basically just said the emperor had no clothes. I mean, it was somewhat saying what people have known for many years but never said out loud, which was that this system doesn't work. The FCC, over 75 years, has renewed more than 100,000 licenses. It has denied only 4 renewal applications due to the station's failure to meet its public interest obligations. No license renewals have been denied in the last 30 years. This is despite the fact that everyone, the stations and public interest groups and the government, say, oh, yes, stations have public interest obligations to serve their communities. That was the quid pro quo. They got the spectrum from the taxpayers. It's the public spectrum. So what are we going to do about it? One thing we said is, though not a panacea, improve the disclosure. So we require these stations to gather all this information. It's called the public inspection file. So it turns out that in the intervening years, this thing called the internet was invented, and we said, why don't we let the public inspect the public inspection file instead of keeping it locked up in filing cabinets, put it online. And I'm very excited to say that a few weeks ago, the FCC approved what's called a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, a major step to take the public files that are part of the broadcaster's obligation and put it all online. There are two areas where I think this could really have the biggest impact. One is political disclosure. The stations currently gather information about political ads, not just for federal, but state and local, which makes it actually more encompassing than the Federal Election Commission rules. And another thing that's even better than the FEC rules, it's in real time. It has to be done within 24 to 48 hours. So unlike with the FEC stuff where, you know, all the good stuff happens in the last 2 weeks, but you don't find out about it until after the election's over, in this case, you can actually, if you were to go around to all the TV stations, get it in real time. So now we're saying put that online so someone sitting anywhere in the country will be able to see spending patterns across the whole country within 48 hours in terms of what's going on in TV stations. Now, this is just breaking, right? So this they've proposed this rule, and I would assume that there's going to be some pushback on this. So if you're looking for something to do that can help this process, pay attention to what happens in the next 30 to 60 days on this, because it may be that there's going to be pushback to water this down. Another thing that was in this proposal was we had a discussion in this report of what we call pay for play, quoting Stacy Wolfel. I don't know if he's here. Okay. Well, it's one of the most egregious things in the whole report, I think, was, you know, examples of stations that basically sell their newscasts or portions of their newscast to an advertiser. So you get an advertisement from a hospital who says, sure, we'll advertise on your newscast as long as you agree to only interview people from our hospital or work from this list of story ideas. Now, we're not saying this is the majority of stations, but it is a meaningful minority, and it seems to be persisting. So it turns out there is already a law called the Sponsorship Identification Law that says you're supposed to disclose things like that. This was a relic of the Paola scandals, radio Paola scandals. But it goes by in this little fleeting thing at the end of a broadcast. No one knows what it means. No one knows what it means to say sponsorship consideration provided. So we said, this is another example where a simple change to use the digital technology could really help. Now, if you put it, the proposal is, if you put it on air, if you disclose it on air, you should disclose it online too, and thereby create a permanent searchable record of every station that is doing this, so that watchdog groups can now start to pull together who are the stations that do this most, which are the chains that do it most, which are the ones that do it least. In general, transparency is a good thing. It empowers citizens. It also makes journalists' job easier. So whether it's C-SPAN or putting more information online, this is, as one of the speakers said, is a powerful trend that is underway and needs to just keep going, and journalists should really be at the forefront of making sure that that happens. I think that you heard earlier today a little bit about one of the recommendations related to advertising spending. Federal government spends $1 billion a year, or between $500 million and $1 billion a year, on advertising. A lot of it, most of it, I think something like 95% of it goes to national media. These are things like Army recruitment ads, stuff like that. So we said, you don't have to spend a dime more, but how about if you spend it locally instead of nationally or in addition to nationally? And there are now technologies and companies like TVB that can allow for one-stop shopping for advertisers and get some of that money into local media. Make sure that nonprofit media can have sustainable business models. One thing that's happened recently that is very alarming, even more so than it's gotten worse since the report came out, is that the IRS is now stopping or delaying the approval of nonprofit media outlets. This is a big, big deal. If this continues, it could really choke what has been one of the most hopeful things that have happened, which is the rise of this new entrepreneurial nonprofit sector in the news business. And it's a little bit unclear exactly what's happening. Is it because they don't... The scary prospect is two fronts. One is that they're deciding that journalism doesn't count as educational content in the way that they've always said it, you know, often have said in the past that it did. And two is that they may be saying that nonprofit news things look too much in their business practices like for-profit. They might, you know, they use websites and phone apps and maybe even have ads. And that means they look like commercial operations. If that's the standard they use, it's going to be a huge blow. Finally, last but not least, universal broadband. It's the sort of the spine to all of this. If you don't have universal broadband, it is a problem both in terms of equity and economics. Equity, obviously, because if the news and information that is thriving is online and you're not online, then you're left behind as a citizen in terms of the civic information you have and information about health and education, jobs. As you know, McDonald's now requires you to apply for jobs online. So it's intolerable to not have universal broadband. As a matter of economics, it's important too. Simply, if you had universal broadband, that would mean an increase of 50% of the traffic online. So you can imagine that that might help with some of the local web properties having successful business models. So this is, I am aware, a somewhat a gloomy picture that I've talked about here a little bit, and I don't mean it to be overly gloomy, because if you really step back from it, you could see that you have these real gaps that are very significant, and I think I emphasize the gaps more because I think everyone's so excited about the innovations that the gaps can kind of fall to the side. But if you can figure out a way of filling these gaps while preserving the innovations that are real, you will actually have, I think, the best media system that you've ever had, that we've ever had as a country. So I think there is a sense of urgency about fixing this, but it need not be just a sense of urgency about, you know, sticking your finger in the dike and keeping things from getting worse. We are at a crossroads where if we can figure out the right combination of how to do these things, our media system will better serve its citizens than it ever has before. Thank you.
Before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. Now, the FCC report recommended that the federal government spend more of its advertising dollars in local media markets. Currently, more than 90% of the advertising goes to national media outlets. But Amy McCombs, the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Journalism School, said there could be a downside. McCombs asked Global Journalist's managing editor, Pat Smith, about the ways governments use advertising to stifle press freedoms.
And around the world, many, many countries and dictators use advertising dollars as a lever over free flow of press. And would you comment on that, Pat?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, that's exactly what you've said, is that many places, if the government likes what you're saying, they'll give you advertising, and if they don't, they take it away. And if you have that kind of a relationship, this is your biggest advertiser, I do think that it's going to filter down into the newsroom what you say. And so there's a lot of self-censorship. A lot of international journalists that have a lot of government advertising, they say, well, we know what we shouldn't report on, so we don't do it. And I think that that's sometimes it's not a real overt action by the government, but I think when you have a government involved that way, of course, I think you can sell them advertising the way you would sell anybody if it's a client. But I think when they start hanging it over your head as to give it to this newspaper in this community or this newspaper, you know, then there's the problem of them having more influence than they should.
The symposium participants also examined the potential impact of the FCC's recommendations on commercial and nonprofit media. KBIA's news director, Janet Saidi, raised the issue of funding for nonprofit news operations during a different panel on media innovations. Here she is speaking with Frank Morris, news director for the public radio affiliate in Kansas City.
So let me move on to funding then. So because we've been reading in the FCC report, and I think it's true that the nonprofits are collaborating, innovating, but big question mark, how do you pay for it? Can you all, no one's shouting at me yet about time, but can we just briefly, each of you, address what are the challenges for funding, but more importantly, I think, what is your vision for funding? And you touched on that, Nicole. So let's start with Frank and just go down on that.
Well, I'm really sort of befuddled by this question. I mean, we have this sort of angel funding from CPB that is wonderful, and they don't really ask very much except for some reporting and to do the kind of work we want to do anyway. Moving forward, though, we have this sort of bundle of stations that are all trying to figure out how do we, you know, pay the underwriting people and incent the stations to run the underwriting and somehow pool the money so that, you know, our expenses at we have three people at KCUR and, you know, four if you count me, working on this project, and then the other stations have their reporters to support. You know, it becomes extremely complicated very quickly, and we have, you know, great buy-in and people want to make it work, and I think we're moving toward those kind of solutions, but you know, we have the organizations that want to give us money, Monsanto, ADM, Archer Daniel. DuPont. These are organizations that have negative. You know, that you don't necessarily want to see their ad right next to your story about, you know, the seed industry or what have you. And CPB has reservations about seeing those ads adjacent to these stories. So, but on the other hand, you know, they're the low hanging fruit, and they're big low hanging fruit. So, you know, we have issues to work through, and we're proceeding. But you know, as far as the long term funding of this, I think it's a very it's a difficult thing. I mean, I wish we had a model that was in place and working.
In this groundbreaking report, the FCC acknowledges that its policies and regulations are out of sync with swiftly evolving media markets. So now the FCC is trying to modernize. Only time will tell if the agency is successful. We hope these two programs provided some insight in the journey that the FCC is embarking on. And now we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Our director is Travis McMillan. Pat Akers engineered the audio. Raymond Tungekar is our lead producer. Thank you for joining our program. And again, you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org, which is a new address for us, or our Facebook page. I'm David Reed for Global Journalist.